Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, everybody. I'm David Green. So I'm just wondering, are you sick yet of joking with your friends about how the world feels like it's totally falling apart? I mean, honestly, things do feel pretty bleak right now, so it's worth those conversations. We've seen this rise in global conflict. It's been a slow crawl towards economic recovery. There's climate change, angry politics, and I'm not going to suggest that our little show can change a whole lot, but at least we can sit together and talk through some things and talk about ways that people are trying to find solutions and make things feel a little less bleak. And I want to start in a country that right now feels as dark as ever, and that is Russia. You know, I actually lived there from 2009 to 2012, and I remember this glimmer of hope, this feeling that a pro-democracy movement was building inch by inch and might one day challenge Vladimir Putin, or at least bring some new ideas and some different energy once he was gone. But now the person who was galvanizing that optimism is gone. Alexei Navalny, who was 47 years old, died in a remote Russian penal colony. He had survived a previous attempt on his life by poisoning in 2020, but didn't survive this time. Alexei Navalny was this symbol of hope for those who were dreaming of a Russia without Putin. And now those people are really feeling the despair. But one hopeful voice has emerged in recent days, and it's that of Navalny's widow, Yulia.
Меня не должно было быть на этом месте. Я не должна была записывать это видео. На моем месте должен быть другой человек. Но этого человека убил Владимир Путин.
She released this video to the world saying that Putin killed her husband, the father of her children, the most precious thing she had in life. And Yulia vowed to continue her husband's fight. And she called on people to stand with her and to share the anger at people who have destroyed their future. And that's where I want to begin this week. Mo Alethi is here with me. He's executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He's former communications director for the Democratic National Committee and a former advisor to Hillary Clinton. Sarah Isger is out this week, but we're very lucky to have Michaela Carr joining us. Michaela was the chief of staff and general counsel to the former Speaker of the House, Republican Kevin McCarthy. Mo, hello to you as always. And Michaela, welcome and thanks for doing this with us.
Thanks for having us.
How long did you work with McCarthy?
I was with McCarthy in various capacities for over 4 years as his general counsel when he was leader, general counsel when he was speaker, and ultimately the chief as his speaker's chief.
Well, we're grateful to have you with us. And I guess I really do want to start with Russia. And I just listened to the voice of Alexei Navalny's widow there calling on all of us to feel the anger and to stand with her. And I wonder, what do you take that to mean when it comes to us in the United States? I mean, what should Americans and the people we've elected be doing right now to stand with her?
Well, you play that clip and you hear her voice. I think she is a beacon of light and a beacon of hope and a real vision of strength. Imagining what she has not only experiencing right now, but what she has experienced over the last several years. A friend of mine said, well, why did he go back? Upon the news of his death, they said, wasn't he just poisoned? Why did he go back?
Yeah, we should say after he was poisoned and survived, he could have stayed in Germany, and instead he went back to Russia and was arrested.
He could have stayed in Germany. Yeah. Yes, he could have stayed in Germany, and many other places would have been happy to have him. And it was because he believed in hope, and he believed in democracy. He believed in freedom. He believed in the freedom for people to self-govern, which is, of course, so incredibly important to America's birthright, America's freedom, and the beauty that is the greatest human experiment of mankind, that is American democracy. And so I think when we look at Yulia and what the torch that she is now taking on, I think it's good to use her at the forefront of our mind of what is happening, but keep it in a historical context. What we're looking at now is not just an evil dictator in Putin, but it is part of a larger new axis of authoritarian, axis of evil, including Putin's Russia, including Xi Jinping's China, and including Khomeini's Iran. And I don't think you can really look at one without the other, because that gives almost an excuse to say this is a one-off or this is a smaller problem. And I think it needs to be discussed in the larger context of not only standing with Yulia, denouncing the murder of her husband, putting the blame where it belongs on an evil authoritarian dictator, and making sure that the world knows that America's on the side of freedom and truth.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked about actually in recent episodes of our show, you know, how a lot of Americans right now are actually less committed to the United States being the kind of police for the world to make sure that democracy survives. And that's happening at a time where, as you just said, we see a rise in authoritarianism like leaders, you know, like Putin. And that really, you know, that's deeply concerning, I think. And Mo, how do we grapple with that? I mean, given the politics in the U.S. we've talked about, but now given we see something like this, that the falling of a pro-democracy warrior in Russia, how should this change the conversation here at home at all, if you think it should?
Well, I hope it means we actually have a real conversation here at home again, because right now we're really not. Look, I agree with everything Michaela said, and it's in moments like this I wish she was advising this speaker. I mean, so a couple of thoughts. One, anybody, and I'm looking right at you, Tucker Carlson, who wants to be an apologist for Vladimir Putin, take a look at this last week, where not only do we have the death of Navalny, which I think most people believe can be laid directly at the feet of Vladimir Putin, we also saw news about the bullet-ridden body of a Russian soldier who had defected being found in Spain. And we heard the story of a young woman with dual U.S. and Russian citizenship being arrested and charged with treason in Russia for the high crime of giving $51.80 to a Ukrainian relief organization. This is who we are dealing with. This is the man that people like Tucker Carlson hold up as a paragon of what a well-run country looks like. This man is no friend to peace or to freedom. And we have to understand that, because Michaela is 1,000% correct. Putting aside the moral implications of what he does, geopolitically, he is a threat. And the alliance he is forging with China, with North Korea, with Iran, poses a major global threat to the West. And so we have to understand that as our starting point. And if there is any question, this should put it to bed. But secondly, it means we have to really take stock of what our role is going to be in protecting against this. And for so long, under the leadership, mind you, of many Republican presidents, the United States took the lead in standing up to then Soviet aggression. That is no longer the case. We talked last week on the show about NATO and how it's raising, how this back and forth about what NATO should and shouldn't be doing is creating real questions amongst our allies, and I think giving license to our adversaries. But bring it even closer to home, this fight over whether or not we should be giving aid to Ukraine is the fact that we cannot as a nation come to terms with our role and responsibility there is giving more license, I think, to Putin to do what he does.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, I wanted to specifically ask about that, Mo, because I feel like, you know, you said we should be having the conversation. I totally agree, and it should be framed in the way that you framed it, Michaela. But we've been, in some ways, having the conversation for a long time now in terms of how to confront Putin. A lot of it has focused on Ukraine. It's been hard, especially recently, to find enough agreement, you know, over aiding Ukraine in the fight against Russia. And Mikhail, I actually wanted to play a little bit of tape from your former boss, Kevin McCarthy, because just before leaving Congress at the end of last year, he was speaking about Ukraine and the Republican Party. And this is what he said.
Look, I support arming Ukraine. That doesn't mean sending them cash, but arming Ukraine. But I have been on the White House even before they sent this supplemental. I said, you guys are doing it all wrong by just sending us a supplemental. And I think the president is failing here because he's not telling the American public what is the mission. Now, we have a lot of members who are Navy SEALs who've been in theater and F-18 pilots, and they're frustrated. They want to support, but they don't want to support an ever-ending war. They want to see what's going on here. And I've really been on the White House. You've got to come down and talk to everybody, but you should listen to them.
And I really appreciated that because I hear him saying there are Republicans, many of them, who get the threat from Putin. They're former military members, some of them, but that Biden is failing somehow. I mean, what do Republicans like the former speaker and others who are hesitant to give aid to Ukraine, what more do they need from this president in a moment like this to come together and stand with him? Where is this disagreement coming from?
I think you have to look in a historical context. And two things that I think need to be looked at when you look at kind of the big picture. One of the things that Speaker McCarthy was saying in that moment, you know, I think at that time the request was for $7 billion. And they'd put this $7 billion number in this supplemental. And we were so frustrated by that specific request because Ukraine didn't need $7 billion. Ukraine needed $120 billion. And so to choose to have kind of a fight over $7 billion was so short-sighted because you knew you were going to have people that didn't want to give one more cent, and you knew you were going to have people that were happy to continue to give money indefinitely. And so to put a fight up over $7 billion and turn that into almost like a symbol for whether the free West supports Ukraine, the free America supports Ukraine, was so short-sighted. And I think that has kind of been the pattern that we have seen. It was short-sighted when we didn't have a stronger reaction to the seizing of Crimea in 2014. It was short-sighted when Russia invaded Ukraine and we didn't give immediately the javelins that were needed. We didn't give immediately the weapons that were needed. Had America and, I think rightfully, Europe responded aggressively and with force, then we wouldn't be in a position where we're fighting over $7 billion. I think that's point one. I think point two is something else that the speaker was talking about, which is making the case to the American people. When we started talking earlier, a few minutes ago, we were talking, and Mo mentioned this as well, about these really aggressive authoritarian regimes posing a threat to democracy worldwide.
Yeah.
I don't think that that is something that we talk about enough to the American people. You know, when I grew up, Reagan was president, and you had these visions of presidents that come before sitting at the Resolute desk and giving an address to the nation about why aid to a country far away that some people have never heard of, who speak a language that we don't understand, is in America's interest in a way that is not condescending, in a way that is not paternalistic, but in a way that explains to people who can't pay their rent, people who don't have money for their groceries, people who are watching the gas prices go up, and explain to them why their country, who isn't paying their rent for them and isn't giving the rental assistance that they think that they maybe need or want, why it's important for their livelihood, their life, and the freedom and survival of democracy in the world, we should be giving hundreds of millions of dollars to a country far away. Hmm. And that is the job of leaders in this country. And I think we collectively have failed at that task.
Mo, is that fair? I mean, could Biden be doing a better job of articulating this?
Well, we collectively can be and should be. And, you know, David, I want to sort of gently push back on the way you framed the last question.
Sure.
When you said that, you know, it feels like we have been having the conversation about how to help Ukraine, how to stand up to Putin.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we did for a while. I mean, what the argument Michaela just made seems quaint. Like, I miss that argument over what is the best way to support Ukraine. We're not having a conversation now about how to stand up to Putin. We are having a conversation about if we should stand up to Putin. And that, to me, is what makes this moment in American history so scary.
All right, we're gonna take a quick break, and Mo and Michaela and I will come back. So you're listening to Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. I'm here with Mo Alethi, and Sarah Isger is out this week, but we have Michaela Carr. She was chief of staff and general counsel to former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. All right, well, I want to move on to a different topic and move from Russia closer to home, but still, you know, on this theme of how we can create a better future and who's trying to solve some pretty big problems right now. And, you know, I think when you look towards the future, you know, children have to be a big part of that conversation, how we invest in them, how we support them, how we protect them. And we've been, you know, doing this 50 states series on Left, Right, and Center, where we take a look at stories on a local level and try and zoom out to see what we can learn about our larger political conversation. And today, our 50 states conversation is going to bring us to Washington, D.C. I know if you're thinking about D.C. statehood, we'll save that for another entire segment on a different show. It's but the issue that I really want to focus on when it comes to the District of Columbia today is the issue of crime.
D.C. is set to close the year with a sobering distinction, one of the few major American cities where violent crime is rising, especially when it comes to carjackings, a crime that has more than doubled this year in the district.
Yes.
So crime numbers across the United States are actually returning to pre-pandemic levels, except for D.C. As NBC4 reported there, carjackings are up. So are homicides. 2023 had the most homicides D.C. has seen since 1997. So what does it feel like in the city? Well, ABC7 in D.C. has been interviewing kids about what it feels like in the city right now.
You can't even walk around here without, like, people coming up to you, bullying you, killing you.
So you have many residents, lawmakers in the district who are hoping to turn the tide here. D.C. City Council member Brooke Pinto proposed a big crime bill that City Council is considering. It would expand pretrial detention for juveniles and adults. It would reintroduce drug-free zones and also expand crackdowns on gun possession and retail theft. And notably, in a city where the defund the police movement gained a whole lot of steam, this bill would expand police powers, including allowing car chases in some situations and also taking away some restrictions on chokeholds. So I just want to start with both of you. I mean, you both live in Washington, D.C. I did, but don't anymore. How bad is it? What does it feel like?
I live in the district. And, you know, I've lived in D.C. longer than anywhere else in my life. I moved here to go to college, and except for when I was out working on a campaign, this has been home. I've been here first moved to D.C. more than 30 years ago. I've never felt this anxious in this city. And it's palpable. The concern that people feel is real, and it's palpable. I live in a part of the city where we don't see as many homicides as we see in other parts of the city, but we're seeing a huge increase in carjackings. And these are carjackings being conducted, a majority of so far, by teenagers. And so it's having a real psychological effect, I think, on people who don't normally feel impacted in a real way, in a personal way, by DC's crime rates. I feel like while city leadership is now starting to talk about it, they were maybe a little late.
Michaela, I know you live in Virginia in the suburbs, but I know you work in D.C., obviously.
Yeah, you know, and I lived in D.C. for 20 years. It was similar to Mo, the longest that I've ever lived somewhere. All three of my boys were born in D.C. My husband is a native Washingtonian, born and raised in D.C., and it's really different than it was 20 years ago, and it really is different than it was even 10 years ago. But I think what Mo just said about them DC taking a little bit too long, I think is an understatement. I agree with it, but I think, you know, just like with everything, putting things in context, it was only March of 23 when the DC tried to pass a new overhaul to their criminal justice code that basically removed all the penalties for the things that Mo just mentioned, including reducing penalties for carjacking. And only because the federal government, Congress, vetoed that bill or overruled the DC kind of criminal justice redux that really eliminated penalties for things like carjacking, eliminated penalties for violent crime. We talk often about a pendulum swinging. You usually don't see him swing this far and this fast. And it feels in DC like just wildly grasping at straws. This Pinto-led bill that you mentioned increases things like penalties on carjacking,
right,
which in March of 23, they were trying to reduce the penalties on car. It's like that wasn't even a full year ago. And so it just seems like a really politicized, reactionary attempt to throw spaghetti at the wall and see if anything's going to stick.
Yeah.
When you have real systematic problems, I think it was only 2 years ago that the federal prosecutors trying to prosecute cases in DC declined to prosecute 67% of arrests. Well, if you're a cop in DC and 67% of arrests you turn over to the federal government, because that's how prosecutions work in DC, and 67% aren't even being prosecuted, you know, it's just really exasperating, I think, is the word for it. And ultimately, where you started is, who's being the most harmed? Well, of course, the citizens of DC are being harmed, but a lot of the victims are the kids in these underserved areas, kids that were, you know, without a lot of supervision, kids that whose schools had closed during the pandemic, kids who have the least amount of resources and wealth and availability to thrive, and then being told that things like carjacking are no big deal and we're not going to prosecute them anyway, and we're not going to prosecute gun possessions. We're not going to prosecute gun possessions, of course, in DC, where having a gun is unlawful, but we're not going to prosecute these, and then we're going to be surprised when these same kids are running around shooting each other.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really short-sighted.
I mean, I will say this. I think city leadership, as we both agree, was slow to this. I will give the mayor a little bit of credit, because I feel like she was sounding the alarm. She did stand up and tried to and attempted to veto that first criminal justice bill that passed through the council. And I think that was the right thing to do. She has been pushing in her last campaign. She did push and announce a major push to recruit and fund new positions for police officers, where we are seeing a massive shortage of police officers in the district. She's trying, and some of her opponents were very much against it. She's been leading that charge. Part of this is also the uniqueness, the screwiness of DC's criminal justice system, because of the fact that we are not a state and that we are a federal jurisdiction. The responsibility for criminal justice matters is split. There are more law enforcement officials per resident in this city than anywhere else, but many of them don't do crimes, right? They are protectees, Secret Service. They guard certain federal buildings. The prosecutor is not a local prosecutor. In fact, the DC Attorney General only has jurisdiction over a narrow swath of criminal cases, but the federal prosecutor who is responsible for DC crimes is stretched way too thin because he's a federal prosecutor.
It's a bureaucratic mess. I mean, it's a bureaucratic mess when it comes to
100%. We even had our crime lab decertified at one point about 2 years ago, which meant we had to outsource all of that stuff. It is now back, or at least partially back, as of the end of last year. But it is, we don't have the resources, we don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the things that a lot of other cities that are seeing a decrease, we don't have those things. That's not to say that it's excusable, because mm-hmm. it's not, but there need to be some reforms, not just to how many cops we put on the street, but some reforms into how this district does criminal justice if we're going to really move the ball down the field.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. And we're talking about the conversation around crime in the District of Columbia, which is one American city. Unlike so many others, D.C. is seeing an increase in crime and carjackings and homicides. And I just, as we look at D.C. as sort of a case study for some of the larger solutions that we might find, because I think that's what we're all about, right? I mean, investing in solutions early. So, you know, your kids who, you know, I know you're both parents, live in, you know, in D.C. or in the D.C. area, don't have to face a future that where they're afraid to go outside and walk the streets. And I guess I just wonder, I mean, I look at some of this bill and, you know, reducing restrictions on chokeholds, allowing more police car chases. You know, Mo, you said, you know, expanding the number of police officers on streets. You know, we not so long ago had, you know, a big debate in our country about whether, you know, to defund police, whether more police on the streets were a problematic because they specifically, you know, were a threat to people of color in cities like the District of Columbia. What should we make of this moment? I mean, do we need to revisit a lot of that debate? And how do we expand police power without threatening minority communities and without making, you know, the risk of police violence greater?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I think that debate you're talking about was not as big as sometimes we make it out to be. Right. There was
sounded pretty loud at that time. I mean, and
loud is not big. Loud is not okay. Legitimate, as we see too often in our politics. The mainstream of the Democratic Party, the mainstream of the African-American community does not want to defund the police. D.C. has defunded the police, not by choice, but by attrition. We've lost cops who have walked away, and we have a bunch of vacancies that need to be filled. They can't hire enough people to be police to fill all the slots they already have. So we've essentially already seen a police force that was gutted, and we've seen the impact. The people that are best served by having cops are the ones who are the most loudly calling for more cops to come into their communities. And that is where the mainstream of the Democratic Party has always been. It's why Joe Biden pushed back on the defund the police back when he was candidate Biden. That luckily did not really become the mainstream of the party or take hold in the policymaking here in D.C., with the closest exception being that bill that Michaela referenced that the Democratic mayor vetoed and was not very popular here in the district. We need to invest in our cops. We also need to invest in violence prevention programs. That is key. And there are some efforts to create more community-based violence prevention programs targeting primarily youth. There needs to be a better opportunity, and this is something Gretchen Whitmer has done to great effect in Michigan, to take guns that should not be on the streets, that are in the wrong hands, out of those hands. We talk about that on the show often, enforcing the gun laws that we already have. Wasn't that long ago that DC was a city that did not allow firearms in the district at all? And that got overturned by the courts. Guns came into the city by fairly large numbers, but the enforcement mechanism wasn't there to keep those guns out of the hands of violent offenders, which by law is supposed to happen. And so trying to focus on those things, but both the U.S. attorney and the city officials say they don't have the resources to target that the way they need to. So there's lots of steps that can be made at the policing level, at the law enforcement level, at the community violence prevention level that need to happen and that are happening to greater effect in other cities where we are seeing a decrease.
I think we just saw a good reminder as of why Mo is in charge of communications for then candidate Hillary Clinton. It was a beautiful obfuscating there. Big does not mean loud or serious, or
we
loud
lost.
Does not
we
mean
had,
big.
We lost that race, so I don't know.
I will say though, he hits on a couple of points. One is I do think Mayor Bowser gets credit, but when Mo said that bill that we got rid of through federal action, through leadership of Speaker McCarthy, when we got rid of that bill that Mayor Bowser had vetoed, before she vetoed it, it passed unanimously. So it wasn't that it wasn't popular. I mean, it passed unanimously. She vetoed it. They passed it again. with a veto override and was like, no, how dare you tell us that we can't say that carjacking's no big deal.
You're saying, I just want to make sure our listeners understand that this was a bill that would have reduced some penalties for crimes.
That right. It would have reduced penalties for violent crimes and reduced the authority. So
right.
Very
Mayor
much
Bowser kind of vetoed it. Congress also vetoed it with McCarthy's support. But you're saying, Michaela, it was significant that a lot of people who make laws in D.C. were saying, let's reduce penalties for crime, which they're now going back on.
But to be clear, when I say it wasn't popular, I meant amongst D.C. residents, not amongst the D.C. council. D.C. the council was sort of working against what most residents, I think, wanted.
Well, this is a reminder that leadership matters. I mean,
that's exactly right. And I think that, you know, what's interesting there is, and Mo said it well, which is whether it was because of loud or effective talking points or not, the policies that actually the way that DC has been operating and the way that DC has been managing their city is that we do get to see the results of defunding the police. Whether it was because of attrition, because of lack of funding, because of the policies that were made, because of the bills that they passed, because of their decision not to prosecute 67% of arrests. Oh, this person was just shoplifting. Oh, this person just had a gun. Oh, this person just had a gun illegally. Oh, this person just had a gun they shouldn't have had. Oh, this person just did an armed assault, but they didn't actually kill anyone. Repeatedly refusing to prosecute the cases when there are arrests made, we are getting to see in real time the result of the defund police talking points and the result of being soft on crime and its real impact, not only on the innocent victims living in the city and trying to go about their life. In this case, that means a lot of federal workers who come into the city to work, people that work in the Capitol, people that work for all of the government agencies that are sprinkled around DC. But I think where we started this conversation, more importantly, the damage that does to communities who are most vulnerable and most susceptible to entering into lives of crime, entering into repeat offender status, because the first offense or the second offense or the third offense or the fourth offense is not taken seriously and they're not given an opportunity to kind of see the error of their ways and change if the city doesn't think it's a big deal. And so we did get a kind of beautiful opportunity to see the benefits of that.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there and we're gonna move on to another threat to children, not just in one city, but everywhere. And that is the threat from social media. And Michaela and Mo and I will be right back. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. All right, welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Michaela Carr is here. She was Chief of Staff and General Counsel to former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. And Mo Alathy is here, Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. We've been talking about ways to fight this feeling that so many of us have that the world is totally falling apart. And again, when it comes to a better future, who should we be thinking about most? It's our kids, right? And what is one of the greatest threats facing them? Social media. Last year, 41 states and the District of Columbia filed lawsuits against Meta, Facebook, and Instagram's, When it comes to solutions, last year, 41 states and the District of Columbia filed lawsuits against Meta, Facebook and Instagram's parent company, saying that they were designing addictive features in their platforms that were causing harm to younger users. Well, New York City recently joined this fight. They filed a lawsuit against most of the major social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, YouTube, saying that they are contributing to a costly mental health crisis among the city's youth. Now, after hours of hearings with some of the leaders of those platforms, the Senate could be close to passing the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill aims to regulate platforms and make them take reasonable care to make their offerings safer for children. And I want to start the conversation with both of you with a little bit of a step back. I know we are all grasping for solutions now, including in Congress, but do we all bear some accountability here for all of us getting so addicted to these platforms and allowing them to grow to a point where they're threatening younger people? Is that part of what we should all be thinking about and learning from as we're thinking about the best way forward, not just turning to Congress and praying that they do something?
I mean, look, I think absolutely. In our house, there's an ongoing joke that our children will be given cell phones when they're no longer in our house. I don't know how long we'll be able to pull that off. Our oldest is only 10, but you know, there is no question that the social media technology has been developed to encourage people to use more social media. It's not a contentious claim. They are
to get us
profit.
Addicted.
Right, that's the point.
Yeah.
They want you to spend time. I enjoy, you know, this is probably a statement on my age. I enjoy Facebook because I get to see pictures of my kids, my friends' children and my family's kids. And I, you know, I'm at that, people want to look at pictures of babies, but I use it for free. I use it for free because they are able to monetize my usage. They put ads to me. They do that because they can make hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars by monetizing me and deciding what it is that I like and sending ads my way. And so if anyone thinks for a second that these massive companies are not attempting to monetize usage and are not doing so in a way purely to drive profit margin, then you're being foolish there. And we need to keep focused on they are there to make a profit. They are not worried about your mental well-being. They are not worried about your mental health. Really, you have your own responsibility to put your phone down and not let your kids pick them up.
Well, Mo, before I turn to you, I want to play some tape from a recent hearing. This was Democratic Senator John Ossoff from Georgia questioning Meta's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg.
Let me ask you a question. Is your platform safe for kids? I believe it is. But there's an important difference between correlation and causation. Because we're not going to be able to get anywhere. We want to work in a productive, open, honest, and collaborative way with the private sector to pass legislation that will protect Americans, that will protect American children above all, and that will allow businesses to thrive in this country. If we don't start with an open, honest, candid, realistic assessment of the issues, we can't do that. The first point is you want kids to use the platform more. In fact, you have an obligation to. But if you're not willing to acknowledge that it's a dangerous place for children, the internet is a dangerous place for children, not just your platform, isn't it? Isn't the internet a dangerous place for children?
I think it can be. Yeah, there's both great things that people can do and there are harms that we need to work together.
Yeah, it's a dangerous place for children. There are families here who have lost their children.
I mean, Mo, it's just amazing that that's where we are. Like, we're literally starting at the basics. Like, is it dangerous?
We just had a conversation about crime rates in D.C. in which I admitted how uncomfortable, for the first time, unsafe I feel in D.C.
Yeah.
I feel safer letting my kids play outside than I do keeping them inside and giving them a device. Mm. I feel my kids are safer outside than inside my own home right now. And it's for all of the reasons. And that was such a remarkable hearing. Because, I mean, Michaela, when else are you going to find that level of bipartisan outrage towards anybody? I found myself watching that hearing on TV, nodding to Lindsey Graham and Josh Hawley, and then thinking something was wrong with my neck, right? Like, what am I doing there? Just as much as I was nodding to Blumenthal and to Klobuchar and some of the more progressive voices. There is a real bipartisan recognition right now that something has got to be done. The social media companies are falling short. They keep saying, please, Congress, regulate us. We need some guidance from you. We need you to regulate us. And then every time Congress says, okay, here's something we could do, you know, they kick into high gear pushing back on it. There's got to be some sort of accountability measure. Now, having said that, accountability alone is not going to solve this problem because social media and the internet is not going to go away. And no matter what we do, and I think there's a lot we can and should do, the internet moves faster than all of us do. And AI is moving faster than any of us are. And so there are other things that I think we need to be doing. I want to start with age-appropriate media literacy for children in school. We need to start, just like so many schools right now are doing health literacy, they're doing financial literacy. I want to see media literacy in our schools where young people are able to learn at an age-appropriate level throughout the course of their education how to tackle some of this stuff, how to tackle misinformation and disinformation and a lot of the nasty stuff that's coming in and how it impacts their mental health. And for particularly for young girls, my daughter's in middle school, you know, how it impacts sort of their body image and all of it.
That'd be great. I feel like we talk about media literacy and often it's like, let's talk about freedom of the press and the importance of, you know, news. And I obviously I love that more than anything, but to actually focus as well on social media and things like, you know, body image. And that, I mean, that sounds really
I want to lead with that in the younger grades so that, you know, we've talked on the show a while ago about the lesson my daughter learned when her school did a week-long lesson in the second grade studying the Pacific Northwest tree octopus. And at the end of the week, find out that that was just an internet hoax. And that simple lesson that not everything on the internet is true is something that she has never lost. And I kind of feel like the tree octopus needs to be taught to half of Washington right now, half the people on the Hill.
Yeah, I could think of a lot of people that'd be a good lesson for. Michaela?
I think that's great. And I think Mo makes a really good point there. And every now and then I'm buoyed up by the idea that I can bring Mo over to the dark side with libertarian leanings. I think he makes a really good point that, you know, the answer might not be in the answer might not be in Congress, right? I mean, yes, you know, you mentioned or we heard from Ossoff, he's got a great bill called the Report Act, partnering with Senator Blackburn. It's the Senate version of the House bill that's Laurel Lee from Florida is leading. But the reality is that the solution is not in Congress, right? We can create a bill. It may or may not take 4, 5, 6 Congresses to get through. I mean, this is the third Congress that the kids, the COPA has been, we've tried to move it. There's a lot of pushback to moving it for a lot of really good reasons, including what that means for enforcement, you know, giving the FTC basically unmitigated enforcement to write a new regulation that they do or do not like something. You have a lot of free speech absolutists saying that this kind of censorship online is really dangerous. And I think it kind of harkens back to a really interesting conversation that we have had for several years now about overarching reform for Section 230, whether this small provision in the Communications Decency Act of 1996 that was meant to clarify that if somebody posts a blog on the internet, that the internet provider isn't responsible for the content of the blog post, has really been kind of perverted into this massive immunity for really huge tech companies. And I think, you know, Justice Thomas in 2022 wrote a really interesting dissent that was saying, look, we need to take a look at why we should or should we at all allow companies, large companies especially, immunity from their own acts or omissions. And here in the hearing that we're talking about, we have these massive tech companies admitting either out in their out loud voice or through their terms of service and through the documents that exist, that they create algorithms to get people to target certain information, that for teenage girls, they can figure out within very, very short time frame of a teenage girl opening an account, her age, what her interests are, and immediately start feeding things like body image, stuff that promotes drug use, stuff that promotes body dysmorphia, stuff that promotes anorexia.
So awful.
And should we have laws on the books that protect massive technology companies? I think the answer to that is no. I'm not sure that the solution is in giving the FTC authority to determine how that happens. So I think we're kind of a long way away from an actual answer there, but I think Mo's onto something in that the solution should be let's teach people on their own how to navigate things better since Congress won't be able to keep up.
I think so too. I do, you know, as we wrap, I mean, I want to bring us kind of full circle because it is not insignificant, Mo, that you were nodding watching Republican Senator Lindsey Graham in a hearing about social media, because there are a lot of Republicans and Democrats who have at least come together saying this is a problem and we need to figure out how to solve it, whether it's, you know, it's laws or whether it's encouraging the kind of social media literacy you were talking about. And that's where I hope we can get with Russia, with Putin. There might not be answers to confronting authoritarian regimes, but it would be really nice if we don't have to be spending time watching bickering over $6 or $7 billion in an aid package, but actually the parties coming together and saying this is an enormous threat to our society, to humanity, and we have to do something about it. It would be lovely if we got back to that point where we could at least say that Vladimir Putin is an enemy and that Russia is an enemy and a lot of people in that country deserve a better future. To not be able to speak with one voice about that among the leaders that we have elected is really troubling and a shame. So let's get there. Okay, we're going to leave it there. And we're going to turn to our left, right, and center rants and raves. And Michaela Carr, it's your first time on our program, so the floor is yours. What do you want to talk about?
So I'll give it a mini rant, but then I'm going to pivot. So the mini rant is the absolute naked pandering of the Biden administration right before an election to try and cancel a whole lot of student loans. Obviously, student loans cannot be canceled. Loans cannot be canceled. It passes the cost on to someone else. What the latest estimates are that it would be a $550 billion regulation. And the real problem that I see is that it exacerbates problems of college costs and subsidized graduate loans at a rate that we're unwilling to subsidize federal housing. So that was my rant. I'll keep it short because I do want to say that on the state of the world, my rave is that I'm really optimistic. We talked about three really interesting things, as you always do on this show. But I think in reality, you had Mo and I kind of highlighting the left and the right. But I think the normal American voter agrees on 90% of the things that we discuss. They agree that Putin is evil. They agree that DC crime is too bad and we need to find a solution there. And they agree that social media is a danger. And so that's going to be, instead of a rant, a little bit of a rave that we agree, as usual, on more than we disagree on. And that is the beauty of American democracy. Disagree on the details, but agree on the big things. And there's great hope for the state of the country.
I love that. Love your optimism. Mo?
Well, I said it earlier, but my mini rant is that more Republicans in leadership don't take Michaela's counsel. Thank you so much, Michaela, for being part of this week. My bigger rant, though, and this one is, there was so much content this week to choose from, so much to rant about. but I'm going to focus on one that that really bothered me, at the very least in the confusion it's creating, and that is the Alabama Supreme Court's ruling that is resulting in IVF and fertility treatments across Alabama coming to an absolute halt out of fear of legal retribution. For a movement that portends to be pro-family, to do something that would put a halt to fertility treatments that is sort of the last resort for so many people to start a family is beyond the pale for me. And it seems that more red states right now are looking at similar types of approaches. They say this is in the interest of the pro-life movement. You can be pro-life, but to have a policy that puts an end to the last recourse for so many people trying to start a family, to me, seems just cruel.
Okay. I'm going to rave about Beyonce. Her new song, Texas Hold'em, first of all, is awesome. But also the song jumped to the top of the Billboard country chart. And Beyonce is now the first Black woman to ever be there. The song is great. Her other new song is great. But I also want to rant and rave about KYKC Country Radio in Oklahoma. A week or so ago, a listener requested Beyonce's Texas Hold'em. The station said, "We don't play Beyonce as we are a country music station." People started accusing the station of racism, and this almost became the latest painful battle in our culture war. But the GM overseeing the station quickly explained that the station had not yet heard that Beyonce had released some country tracks. they are playing the song now. That is all the time we have for today. I want to thank you, Michaela Carr, and you, Moa Lathy. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Thank you for being here, and come back next week. We will have more Left, Right, and Center.
And I'll be damned if I cannot dance with you. Baby, pour that sugar and liquor on me too. Boots, solagenic, photogenic, shoot.